this lecture, entitled Moses Mendelssohn and the Beginning of the Haskalah Movement, is dedicated to the merit and honor of Charles and Sally Eaton and their sons. As we pointed out in the past lectures, Jewry in the 18th century was in the midst of a spiritual crisis. There was a growing number of Jews who were basically ignorant, spiritually stagnant, and despised by their more fortunate and educated brethren. Those who were privileged to become knowledgeable in Torah, by and large, focused their efforts at that time in the area of Pilpul, Talmudic dialectics, often of the price, as the Gaon of Vilna pointed out, of gaining true insight into the Torah. In the opinion of their critics, the exercise of these brilliant Pilpulistic expositions developed scholars that were very much centered on themselves and their accomplishments, to the exclusion of others, and ultimately made the study of Torah less respected in the eyes of many. In addition, as Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto pointed out, not enough effort was expended on moral and ethical development, and accordingly, in his opinion, its deficiency was glaringly apparent. It was in the midst of all of this that the Baal Shem Tov and the Hasidic movement arose in Eastern Europe with its stated goal, the reinfusion of spirituality in Jewish life. Those opposed to the Hasidic movement and their innovations, the followers of the Gaon of Vilna, were also sensitive to the above-mentioned problems, but they took another path to revitalize Jewish life. Using the Gaon as their example, they abandoned to a great extent the Pilpul approach to Talmudic study and embraced a much more basic and what we would call today a scientific approach, concentrating first on gaining proficiency in Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, Hebrew language, then Mishnah, then Talmud, then the Halachic codes, all with an eye to uncover the underlying governing principles of the many branches of the Torah. Some of the school of the Gaon, following his example, also gained proficiency in mathematics and science, but only as an adjunct to Torah study. The sole aim of all of this was the search for truth, spirituality, and the fulfillment of the commandment to dedicate one's life to Torah. To better understand the sources of their worldview, let me quote to you from the section in the Torah that deals with a covenant that was made between Hashem and the people of Israel while the Jews were still at the foot of Mount Sinai. It's on your first page. And this is in the last section, B'chukosai, of the book of Vayikra of Leviticus. And it begins here in chapter 26, verse 3. If you walk on my statutes and keep my commandments and do them. In other words, there are three conditions. Walking in the statutes, second, keep my commandments, and three, do them. I will then give you, and this begins a whole long list of blessings, your rain in their season, and the land shall yield her produce, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. And it goes on from verse 4 to verse 14. In chapter 26. And it continues on in verse 15, if you will not listen to me and will not do all of these commandments, if you reject my statutes and your soul will abhor my ordinances, so you will not fulfill all of my commandments and you break my covenant, even though there's a long list here, then I will do likewise and will make you subject to terror. And this begins all of the curses of the Tochacha, which is the rebuke, which is really part of the covenant. In other words, this was the covenant that Hashem made with the Jewish people. If you fulfill the Torah, this will happen. If you don't, that will happen. And it goes on. There seems to be redundancy of the phrase, if you walk in my statutes, with the phrase, keep my commandments. What are the two things? And the Medrash saw in it really a hint. Not only does it mean literally walk in my statutes to live a Jewish life, but also, and I quote here, this is from the Sifra, the Halachic Midrash, which in addition Rashi quotes, if you walk in my statutes, I might have thought this refers to the fulfillment of the commandments. But since it states, quote, and keep my commandments and do them, the fulfillment of the commandments has already been stated. How then shall I explain if you walk in my statutes? It means that you shall toil in the study of Torah. Using the idea of statutes here are really the laws of Torah exposition, to understand how to uncover the oral law, the oral tradition within the written tradition. Using the methodology according to the rules that are outlined in the oral law, the statutes are referring to the divine rules of hermeneutics, as the Gemara in Kedushin calls them medrash. This is the laws here, the chukim, are really the laws of medrash, of really of understanding the Torah. So walking in them is really toiling through them. In other words, to work hard to uncover the truth using these laws. Basically, it would be similar to a scientist who is going through using the methodology and the law, at least the known laws of science, to understand, you know, various phenomena, to break it down. It comes according to this interpretation. There are really actually three parts to this covenant in the positive sense. A, really, "Mechukosai telecha, walk on my statutes," really refers to the Talmud. There is the understanding. The observance, Tishmu, observe, it's understood by the Talmud, this is a Gemara in Kedushin Lamed Zion, referring to Mishnah. As observing means guarding them. As knowing them, or reviewing them. And then finally, says Vasisimoisam, implementing them. So really we're dealing with the idea of study on a deeper level, on a more superficial level in terms of just knowing the knowledge, and then living the life, integrating it into your life. That's really, according to the Talmud, according to the Midrash, that is the basis of the covenant on the positive sense. What's on the negative sense here? We have on page 2. And again, if you will not listen to me, this is Rashi basing himself on the Sifra. If you will not listen to me to toil in the study of Torah and know the interpretations of the sages, I might have thought this refers to the fulfillment of the commandments, because it just says, if you don't listen to me, listening could be understood on various levels. But since it states and will not do all of these commandments, then the fulfillment of the commandments has already been stated. I mean, it seems to be two phrases which are redundant. And evidently one would refer to one idea and the other. How then shall I explain if you will not listen to me? Means if you will not listen to me to toil in the study of Torah. That's the first thing. What is meant by the phrase, to me, listen to me? It is referring to someone who recognizes his master yet intends to rebel against him. In other words, there are people who believe in God, but they don't want to be told what to do. Don't boss me around. I'll do when I'm ready. I'll do it. Don't tell me what to do. Because that's the ideas. He knows I just don't want to be told what to do. I want to be independent. And what's the next phrase? Will not do all of these commandments? I mean, since you will not study, you will not do them. The next level is, well, you're not interested in knowing them. Ultimately, you will not fulfill them. Thus, there are two transgressions. It begins with not studying. The lack of study leads to non-compliance. The next phrase is, and if you reject my statutes. And, I mean, evidently he's not studying, he's not fulfilling. So what does it mean that he has this feeling of rejection? He rejects others who fulfill the commandments. In other words, he just can't sit socially to be with these people. And your soul will abhor my ordinances. And again, the phrase used You feel like throwing up. It's like when we boil, you know, something which is not kosher, we want to get the non-kosher substance out of the vessel. It's called hagolas kalim, like to purge them. So what is this terrible feeling? Horman says he hates the sages. In other words, you don't want to socialize with the people who are observant, and those who are the teachers, you just can't stand. And the next letter, so that you will not fulfill, is alluding to the fact he prevents others from doing them. I mean, we know this historically from antiquity to recent history. All of my commandments, as a distressing my commandments, he denies that I commanded them. For that reason, it is stated all of my commandments, not just commandments. And you break my covenant, this is the last one, he denies the basic principles of religion, is Kofer Beikar, meaning he denies the existence of a providential supreme being. There's not only that he's denied that he didn't command, but he even denies his existence. One thing leads to the other. And the Medrash continues, I mean, this is Rashi, thus there are seven transgressions. The first generates the second, and so on until the seventh. And they are the following. He does not study the oral law, means the Torah in its totality, including the oral law. He does not fulfill the commandments. He rejects others that do. He hates the sages. He prevents others from observing. He denies the divine origin of the commandments. He denies the basic principles of the religion. As he denies the existence of a providential supreme being. Just again, just to appreciate how the Talmud viewed, the Mishnah, the Talmud viewed the place of the oral tradition. I just to quote to you, and I think it's just important not only just, you know, to understand it itself, but in historical light, to understand that this was the guiding principle of the Jewish community, these texts, for thousands of years. This is taken from the Gemara in Sanhedrin in 99a in Tzadik Tes Omed Aleph. Another Brisa taught, says there's a verse that says, Kidvar Hashem Boza, that if a person who has despised the word of the Lord, he refers to, will be cut, totally, utterly cut off. He will lose his portion in this world and the next. Dvar Hashem Boza. The simple meaning is it's referring to idolatry, but it says idolatry there in the verse. There was really no necessity to explain why. He should just simply said, he who worships idols will be utterly cut off. By describing it in terms as by doing so, he has violated the principle, it seems to me an overarching principle, of Dvar Hashem Boza, despising the word of the Lord. It seems to be more inclusive than just idolatry. What does it include? And this is the Brisa, which is brought in Halachan. This refers to a person who maintains that the Torah is not from heaven. And even if he asserts the whole Torah is from heaven, excepting a particular verse, which he maintains was not uttered by God, but by Moses himself, he's included in Kidvar Hashem Boza, because he's despised the word of the Lord. And even if he omits the whole Torah is from heaven, excepting, I mean, the written law, excepting a single point, a particular Kal Vachomer, that even though that rabbinically it is quoted as part of tradition, but he says it's really their own fabrication. Kal Vachomer deduction, and as it's a logical deduction, a certain Gzeres Shava, which is the comparison of words, which one only, a Gzeres Shava that we can compare to sections of the Torah by the similarity of phrases, really based not just on the similarity of phrases themselves, but a tradition that goes back all the way from Sinai. If he denies that, he is still included in Dvar Hashem Boz, he's despised the word of the Lord. And it continues on, has been taught, Rav Meir used to say, he who studies the Torah does not teach it, deluded in Kidvar Hashem Boz, he's despised the word of the Lord. Because if it's not important enough to teach, evidently you really don't hold of it. Rabbi Nosson says it refers to whoever pays no heed to the Mishnah. In other words, he studies, but he doesn't review what he learns. Again, it's not important to him. Rabbi Noroi said, Kol Shev Shalasek B'Torah Vein Oisek, whosoever can engage in the study of Torah but fails to do so. And this is brought in Shulchan Aruch as well. If a person has the ability, the opportunity, the time to devote himself to the study of Torah and doesn't take that opportunity, I mean, it's indicative, well, it's not important to him. It's not that he's using the time to make a living, you know, to support his family or to expand his knowledge in other important areas that are necessary for his livelihood or understanding Torah, understanding humanity. He's just not interested. It's Dvar Hashem Bozo. So just, it's important to understand that not only from a traditional viewpoint, from a historical viewpoint, this was the view that was espoused by Jewry for thousands of years. On page 3, we find the centrality of the oral tradition, not just the written work. Rabbi Yochanan said, "This is the Holy One, blessed be He." There's a Gemara in Gittin in Samach Amud Beis 60b. The Holy One, blessed be, created a covenant with the people of Israel only because of the oral law. Because the covenant is just not the written law. They understand the Torah itself is understood really as a shorthand, as a notes to this much larger volume of knowledge, which is really the essence of the Torah. And finally, in this section, just understand that they understood Torah as not just an academic discipline, but really the study of the Torah is really the key to transform a person's character, to make him an entirely different person. And I quote here, it's really from the first Mishnah in the sixth chapter of Pirkei Avos, which is really a brisa, it's not part of them, it's an addendum to the Mishnah. Rabbi Meir said, "Whoever engages in Torah study for its own sake merits the acquisition of many things. Furthermore, the existence of the whole world is considered worthwhile solely for his sake. He's called a friend and a beloved of God. He develops a love of the omnipresent and a love of his creatures. He brings joy to the omnipresent and he brings joy to his creatures. The Torah clothes him with humility and the fear of God, makes him fit to be righteous, pious, upright, and faithful. It makes him become distant from sin and brings him near to meritorious conduct. From him, people enjoy counsel and wisdom, understanding and strength, as is stated in Scripture, counsel is mine," referring to the Torah, "and wisdom. I am understanding, strength is mine. The Torah gives him sovereignty and dominion and the faculty of analytical judgment, the secrets of the Torah revealed to him, and he is made as a fountain that even gathers forth like a stream that never ceases. He becomes truly modest, patient, and forgiving of insult towards himself. The Torah makes him great and exalts him above all things." As you see, the approach taken by the Gaon of Vilna and his disciples and contemporaries, the total immersion into Torah study, and the belief that Torah study can literally change one's whole being, is the one that's actually advocated by the Talmud and its related literature. It would also seem that any other approach is actually a falsification of Judaism. At least it was understood by the teachers of the Mishnah and Talmud and the many generations that follow them up until the 18th century. According to Hasidism's defenders, the novel approach was taken by the Baal Shem Tov and his followers was not really so novel. It was never meant to supplant the old order and values, but rather to revitalize them and make them true to their original goals, love of God and His Torah. But in the midst of the crisis of spirit which we've previously described, where classic Judaism began to lose its appeal, another approach was taken. an approach to revitalize the Jewish people not through a rededication to the values and lifestyle espoused by the Talmud and related works, but rather through adopting the refinement and academic pursuits of cultured Western Europeans. In addition, those who espouse that approach often concurrently initiated a program to reacquaint the Jewish people with their ancient heritage through the basics of Hebrew language and a better understanding of the Chumash, the five books of Moses, and the prophets and holy writings. Despite its positive elements, it was by and large a repudiation of the Talmudic tradition of thousands of years and of its current leaders, its then current leaders, the Rabbonim and Rosh Yeshiva of the Jewish communities. Their stated goal was to benefit the Jewish community. After all, they argued, if Jewry were to develop Western mannerisms and become more refined, fluent in German rather than Judendeutsch or Yiddish, and proficient in those areas of Torah which were valued by the Christian clergy and intelligentsia, the Bible, the study of the Hebrew language, as well as in philosophy and science, the Jews would become more acceptable in the eyes of the Gentiles and would ultimately gain equal rights and acceptance, alleviating the terrible poverty and discrimination that was prevalent in Europe at the time. Perhaps even more importantly, they would also benefit from the cultural knowledge of their Hebrew heritage as well as the cultural heritage of Western Europe. It soon became evident, though, that these efforts, instead of revitalizing the Jewish community, actually led to mass conversions to Christianity and the almost total spiritual decay of Western European Jewry. Yes, by making them feel as part of the brotherhood of man and blurring their unique ethnicity, they finally were treated as equals. But in the process, they lost almost any vestige of their Jewishness. Evidently, the study of the Hebrew language and the biblical literature, without a deep grounding in the Talmud, offered little protection to the forces of assimilation. In Berlin alone, it is estimated that 10% of the Jews converted to Christianity in the last decade of the 18th century, and a third converted in the first decade of the 19th century. This does not include the many Jews who ceased to practice Judaism at all, but remained as Jews in name only. As time went on, the situation deteriorated only further. The foremost exponent of this new approach and its most widely respected leader, a person who seemed to embody all of the hope and culture of the age and yet identified himself as a very observant Jew, was a former Talmudic student from Dessau, Germany, who gained much fame and respect throughout the Jewish and non-Jewish world in his lifetime and beyond. His name was Moses Mendelssohn. His life and philosophy are the topics of tonight's lecture. I'd like to begin with a short synopsis of Moses Mendelssohn's life. In his time, he was considered a giant in the field of philosophy. One of his first publications, titled Brief über die Empfindungen, Letters on the Emotions, published in 1755, when he was barely 26, laid the groundwork for a new scholarly approach to understanding the nature of beauty. Like, we take it for granted. But why is it that when we see something, we instinctively feel, this is beautiful? And it's something else, we don't have that feeling. I know you'll be up all night thinking about this, but I'll give you more things to think about. In June of 1763, at the age of 33, he was awarded 50 ducats as the first prize winner in an essay competition by the Prussian Royal Academy of Sciences for his Über die Evidenz in Metaphysischen Wissenschaften, on the evidence of the metaphysical sciences. What makes his victory even more impressive was that the famous philosophers Immanuel Kant and Thomas Abt had also submitted essays in that contest. A few months later, in October, Mendelssohn was granted the privilege of being a Schutzjude, a protected Jew in Berlin with permanent rights of residency, even outside the Jewish ghetto. At the same time, the trustees of the Jewish community in Berlin exempted him from payment of all Jewish taxes. Evidently, they were very proud of him. 9 years later, the community passed a resolution that the, quote, distinguished man shall be eligible to all positions in the community. In the year 1767, he authored his chief philosophical work, proving on the basis of what was then accepted logic. You know, philosophy has changed considerably since his time. That there's life after death. Entitling his work Phaedon, after similarly titled work on the afterlife by Plato. It was the most widely read book in its time. And to this day, Mendelssohn is widely known as a Jewish Plato or Socrates. And in Phaedon, it's really Plato has Socrates as the person who's, you know, who's saying all of this. So I guess Mendelssohn, who made up his own, is either Plato or Socrates. So famous was the work that, in fact, a medal was struck in his honor by the mint of Ansbach, Bavaria. Johann Jacob Speis, the supervisor of the mint, wrote to Mendelssohn asking him to supply some biographical information, which was printed in a numismatic publication describing the medal and its honoree. This is which we will soon quote. On the obverse of the medal is a likeness of Mendelssohn. He wasn't very handsome. On the reverse is a human skull with the inscription Phaedon, you know, referring to death. As a result of his writings, he was even elected to the Berlin Academy of Sciences in the philosophical division. But the appointment was not approved by King Frederick the Great of Prussia. It needed his approval, and therefore he was not actually elected. I mean, he was not actually given the position. The fact that during that period a Jew was the subject of such adoration is truly remarkable. To give you a sense of how Jews at that time were generally viewed, let me quote you from the decree of the Merchants Guild in Berlin, which was the decree was published. It was began 1716, but was still in effect in the year 1802. So this was all during Mendelssohn's lifetime. Quote, this is on page 3. Inasmuch as the Merchants Guild in Berlin is to be composed of honest and honorable persons, the following must be barred from membership: Jews, homicides, murderers, thieves, perjurers, adulterers, or any other person afflicted with great public vices or sins. And some years later, in 1795, this is well after Mendelssohn's death, the official reason for the rejection of a Jewish applicant to the Berlin Academy of Music was, quote, is mathematically impossible that a Jew could be a composer. Despite his renown and personal achievements, Mendelssohn always remained very humble and gracious. The following is an excerpt from the autobiographical information which Mendelssohn supplied the above-mentioned Bavarian mint in connection with the Phaedon medal. Quote, I cannot promise your readers that the circumstances of my life, which really are of little consequence, will prove particularly entertaining to them. My biographical data have actually always seemed so unimportant to me that I never bothered to keep a record of them. Continues on, the main facts I can recall offhand are approximately as follows. I was born in the year 1729, and he has the 12th of Elul, according to the Jewish calendar. That's in the. He didn't know the regular date. In Dessau, where my father was a teacher and Torah scriber Sofer. I studied Talmud under Rabbi David Frankel, who was then chief rabbi. Oberrabbiner of Dessau. He's actually very famed for his commentary on the Talmud Yerushalmi called Korban Eda. Around 1743, this learned rabbi, who had gained great fame among the Jewish people because of his commentary on the Jerusalem Talmud, was called to Berlin, where I followed him that same year. There I developed a taste for the arts and sciences as a result of my acquaintance with as well as some instruction by Mr. Aaron Gumperz, who later became a doctor of medicine. He died a few years ago in Hamburg. Eventually, I became first a tutor in the house of a rich Jew. This was this Isaac Bernhard. Later on, his bookkeeper, and finally the manager of a silk factory, a position I am still holding. Actually, I became a partner in the firm. I was married in my 33rd year and sired 7 children, of whom 5 survive. Incidentally, I never attended a university, nor did I ever listen to an academic lecture. This lack of formal education constituted one of my greatest difficulties, for it meant a great struggle to get an education solely by my own effort and diligence. In fact, I overdid it, and the overzealousness with which I pursued my studies brought on a nervous weakness that renders me all but incapable of any scholarly occupation. This medal was struck in the year 1779. Although he studied under one of the great Talmudists of his day, Rav David Frankel, the author of the commentaries of the Korban, this is the Yerushalmi Korban Eda, and followed him to Berlin to continue his studies. So he actually came to Berlin to continue Talmudic studies. Mendelssohn's life began to take a different direction when he got into his possession a newly printed copy of the Rambam's Mora Nevuchim, Guide to the Perplexed, which he studiously read in secret at night. It seems, according to Mendelssohn's account, that the long hours he spent poring over the Mora Nevuchim harmed his health and caused him to develop a hunched back, a deformation of the spinal column, as well as other health problems. He is quoted as saying that even though the Rambam was the cause of his physical disabilities, the intellectual joy that he brought to his life outweighed any of the discomforts that he caused. The Rambam's approach opened up for him a whole new world of rationalist thinking, one which was foreign to his upbringing, but was in concert to a great degree to the rationalist thought of the philosophers of the Enlightenment. In those early years in Berlin, it seemed, while still a yeshiva student, he came in contact with other Jewish intellectuals. One of them was Yisroel Zamosh, a liberal Talmudic scholar from Poland, born in the year 1700, so he was some 29 years older than Mendelssohn, who was well-versed in astronomy, mathematics, and philosophy. From Zamosh, Mendelssohn learned mathematics and logic. Zamosh also shared with him his love of Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, and much time was spent discussing its contents. And this was a love that was carried throughout Mendelssohn's life. Another one of Mendelssohn's friends was a young Jewish physician from Prague, by the name of Avrom Kish. It was from Kish that he learned Latin. His thirst for general knowledge was such that as soon as he had only barely mastered the rudiments of Latin grammar, he bought a few of the Latin classics and an old Latin translation of the famed English Enlightenment philosopher John Locke's work, Essay Concerning the Human Understanding. This work, one of the classic documents of British empirical philosophy, seems to have had a profound influence on Mendelssohn's future development. It was only deciphered by him with tremendous effort, as his Latin vocabulary at the time was extremely limited. And he was forced to constantly make use of a Latin dictionary. You know, it's like you want to speak in a foreign country. Imagine as you're talking and you don't know the word and you're going to keep on looking up the word. In addition, Locke's views on religious tolerance, the limited role of government, and the basic good nature of man, in contradistinction to Thomas Hobbes, were incorporated into Mendelssohn's outlook on life. You know, we who are really children of the Enlightenment, these ideas are really take for granted. But in those days, they were novel ideas. Another mentor of his was Aaron Gumperz, whom he mentions in his autobiographical sketch. It was through Gumperz, a medical student at the time, that he acquired a taste for the science as well as an interest in the philosophers Leibniz and Wolff. It's truly amazing that without much guidance, Mendelssohn eventually attained great proficiencies in languages, Greek, Latin, French, English, and of course his native German, as well as mathematics, philosophy, and poetry. What was even more consequential for Mendelssohn's future, Gumperz introduced him to several young gymnasium, and that was the high school instructors, and to Maupertuis, the head of the Berlin Academy. Gumperz also introduced him to the Christian Enlightenment writer and thinker Gotthold Ephraim Lessing, who became Mendelssohn's lifelong friend. Lessing was also the most liberal of German authors and a fierce opponent of any form of intolerance. Their friendship made a lasting impression on both of them. To give you a sense of the spirit of the time and the enthusiasm in which the new Enlightenment thinking was embraced, let me quote to you first from the famed Enlightenment thinker Immanuel Kant, his definition of Enlightenment. And it's on page 4. Enlightenment is man's relief from his self-incurred tutelage. Tutelage is man's inability to make use of his capacity to use his reason without outside direction. And this basically, it was really a rejection of traditional knowledge. And for Jews, it was really a rejection of the Masorah. It was a rejection of any imposed knowledge from on high. And he continues on, self-incurred is this tutelage when it is caused not by inability, you know, to employ our faculties to use our reason, but a lack of resolution of courage to use it without outside direction. Saper aude, have the courage to use your own reason. That is the motto of enlightenment. And it carried with it a tremendous optimism that through your own rational thinking, you will find the truth. After some 200 years, over 200 years of post-Enlightenment thinking, we're still very, very far from uncovering the truth. And philosophy has, I mean, if one studies the history of philosophy, has really degenerated, where there's really, one no longer has the optimism, really the one originally had. There are just so many ways of looking at things. And Kant himself, you know, with his critique of pure reason, where basically says the only way we think is because we are programmed, to each one of us, to view the world in certain ways. We never know the truth. We only know the truth through our eyes. So it already becomes very disappointing. So how do you know what you see is the truth? Like there's an old Chinese, you know, dictum that there are three truths. There's your truth, and there's my truth, and there's the truth. But as you see, this view is very much not in, is not together with the traditional view of received knowledge. To give you a sense how Mendelssohn himself was esteemed in the eyes of his friend Lessing, let us read together paragraph D at the bottom of page 4. This is, he wrote in a letter to a friend. This Lessing wrote, Moses Mendelssohn's integrity and philosophical mind makes me anticipate in him a second Spinoza, lacking only his errors and Spinoza's errors to be his equal. To give you a sense of Moses Mendelssohn's philosophical views, I would like to share with you at this point a sampling from Mendelssohn's philosophical writings. First from a pamphlet written prior to his death in 1786. And in it we see his views, yet we see his tremendous humility as well. And he stated, I place my full and unreserved trust in God, who, in his omnipotence, could endow man with the faculty to discover for himself, independent of the dictum of the authority, those truths that constitute the basis for human salvation. So the first, you say, the first idea is God could have endowed man, you know, has the power to endow man with the ability to know things on his own, through his own logic. The second point is, continues on, and I feel a child's confidence in him who, in his loving kindness, would endow man with this faculty. In other words, he says, I can't prove that man has that faculty, but I trust God gave man that faculty. Fortified by this unfaltering faith, I seek enlightenment, and through it, a reasoned conviction wherever I may find them. And praise be my Creator's saving grace and goodness, I think I have found both. As he's found the enlightenment and this reasoned conviction. You know. Moreover, I am sure that any man can find them if only he undertakes his search with open eyes. And this really sums up, you know, his enlightenment philosophy. The next section is from his classic work, Phaedon, written in 1767. The setting of this are the last hours of famed Greek philosopher Socrates' life, right before his death sentence by the Athenian government was carried out. Just as Plato had used this scene as a means of articulating his views on death and dying, so too Mendelssohn uses it to make many telling points. And it's worthwhile to read this together here on page 5. To be sure, the soul cannot form a true image of a being higher than itself, nor even of one possessing greater capabilities. Yet it can conceive of the possibility that something exists which has more substance and is less deficient, something in short more perfect than the soul itself. To put it differently, the soul cannot see more than a glimmer of the most supreme being or highest perfection, for it cannot fully comprehend that being's true nature. By contemplating that which is true, good, and perfect in its own nature, and separating this from the deficient and unessential elements with which it is intermingled, the soul can conceive of a being that is pure essence, pure truth, pure goodness and perfection. And he continues on, as long as it inhabits the body, the soul, we must assume, cannot discern truth. Given this assumption, I can see only two possibilities. Either we shall never know truth, or we shall know it only after death. And his confidence is that God, who gave us the ability to know truth, would eventually endow us with the ability to ultimately know, you know, the final truths, which would be only understood after death. I mean, I'm just taking parts of this. This is a very long essay, this Phaedon. The separation of body and soul is called death. Is that right? Asked Socrates. And this is the Socratic dialogue. Right. Doesn't it follow, then, that genuine lovers of wisdom must bend every effort to come closer to an understanding of death, to learn, that is, how to die? It would seem so. Would it then not be highly irrational, indeed downright ridiculous, if a man, having spent his entire life learning how to die, were sad at the approach of death? That's beyond argument. Actually, then, death can never hold any terror, for the genuine philosopher must always be welcome to him. In other words, his understanding is, since death gives us greater understanding, then a person will look forward to death, because in this view, death is not the extinction of the consciousness, but really the beginning of a higher consciousness. And it continues on, we stated that our spirit cannot be destroyed by nature. Consequently, the soul's possible destruction offers no way out of our predicament. Must turn back. The soul cannot perish. Must endure after the body's death. must act, react, and form concepts. And this is the assumption he has. We therefore have every reason to assume that this striving for perfection, this growing in inner excellence, constitutes the destiny of rational beings, hence also the end purpose of all creation. We may safely say that this cosmic structure, great beyond measure, was created so that rational beings, progressing step by step in moral and spiritual awareness, may gradually become more perfect, finding their happiness in their inner growth. It is inconceivable that the ultimate being should have devised a cosmic plan that would allow the progression of those who strive for perfection to come to a halt, or worse still, they should be suddenly be pushed back into the abyss, losing the fruits of their labor. And then it continues on, to deny the soul's immortality, Socrates added, means, among other things, also to deny God's providence. For all the reasons we have enumerated, we may be absolutely sure that there is life to come, and our hearts and minds may be at peace.
The next citation here is taken from his unpublished writings regarding the it wasn't published in his lifetime, it was published afterwards, regarding the philosophical problem of theodicy. And this is, how do we understand suffering? How does God let suffering in the world? In the light of the existence of this evil by an infinitely good God. And he writes, those who feel that things are badly arranged in this life and in disarray with regard to divine justice do not realize that along with the kind of mechanistic order they would like to see in this world would go the disappearance of all moral values, all virtue and righteousness. In a world where everything would be meticulously arranged according to their notions of divine justice, all virtue would be rewarded, every act that is morally good would have to result in some corresponding material good. Virtue would never suffer, vice never triumph. But in such a world, there would be no opportunity to show pity, patience, generosity, or steadfastness, or to engage in the protection and delivery of the virtuous, or in a fight to the death for friends or country. And whatever virtue might still be pursued would be neither noble nor lovable, nor would vice be ignoble or repulsive. For the former would have become profitable, the latter harmful, and anything one might say about virtue would appear as no more than part of the divine economy. Basically, he's saying that there would be no free will, and there would be no room for us to do anything. We live in an imperfect world which allows us to create perfection in the world. But if everything is perfect, there's no room for us. And if everything is rewarded, and if evil is immediately punished, there's no free will. But as you see, the philosophical views that we've quoted actually echo the sentiments of traditional Jewish sentiment about the subject. His ideals of life after death, about self-improvement, the idea of free choice, of evil in the world, are not original ideas. And probably when he was 14 years old, still studying Talmud under the direction of David Frankel, before he got a hold of Mor Nevuchim, of the Guide to the Perplexed, he probably would have said in non-philosophical language the same thing, which probably if you ask any yeshiva bocher, they would tell you to this day. Because of the inordinate respect afforded him, Mendelssohn was able to use his influence to better the lives of his fellow Jews. In 1774, when the Jews of Endingen and Legnau, the only places in Switzerland which Jews were tolerated, were threatened with new restrictions, Mendelssohn wrote to Johann Caspar Lavater, a preacher in Zurich, with whom Mendelssohn's relations at the time were somewhat strained, having had previously engaged with him in a sharp theological debate. But he asked them to intervene on their behalf, which he did. In 1777, several hundred impoverished Jews were about to be expelled from Dresden, which is located in eastern Germany, not far from his native Dessau. He wrote a letter to the Privy Council Baron Friedrich, this is Wilhelm von Ferber, an admirer of Mendelssohn, to have the decree rescinded. And again, it's interesting. You see his love of the Jewish people and his what he saw as the terrible injustice done to them. Here, just on top of page 6. Expulsion constitutes the worst punishment for a Jew. It means not only being driven out of this or that country, it means, as it were, to be wiped off the face of God's earth. For there's no country whose borders are not barred against him by the ironclad hand of prejudice. And this harshest of punishments is to be endured by human beings, not because they are guilty of some transgression, but simply because they cling to their distinct religious beliefs and have the misfortune to have lost their money. For it is just not possible that under the reign of the best and most charitable prince, under the administration of wise and sympathetic men, such punishment could be meted out to people who have committed no crime. Nor can I believe that the guiltless and poverty-stricken, regardless of their appearance or religious beliefs and practices, will be denied the fire of a hearth or water and shelter. Later that year, when the Jewish community of Königsberg, today Kaliningrad, appealed to him that some Jewish prayers, especially the Aleinu, were anti-Christian, he presented written evidence to the contrary. As a result, the royal order that a government supervisor be present in the synagogue during davening, during worship, was rescinded. I mean, this gives you a sense of what was happening to Jewry at the time. In 1779... I mean, and again, as you understand the impulse that so many Jews wanted to assimilate, because they wanted to avoid all of these of the persecutions that were going on. In 1779, Alsace, the Jews were viciously attacked in a pamphlet written by a French judge. Fearing that their already precarious situation would deteriorate further, they appealed to Mendelssohn to draft an appropriate petition to the French Council of State appealing for relief from their intolerable conditions. Realizing that in order to change Christian opinion regarding the question of Jewish rights and emancipation, the most effective response should be penned by a fellow Christian, Mendelssohn prevailed upon a young publicist and liberal by the name of Christian Wilhelm von Daum to undertake the task. I guess if you want a Christian, that's... The result was a treatise entitled Über die bürgerliche Verbesserung der Juden, the civil improvement of the Jews, which was published in 1781. Dealing with the position of Jews not only in Alsace, but throughout Germany, Dom declared that Jews possess all the qualifications for citizenship, and recommended they be granted civic rights, which he calls as bürgerliche Rechte, but not full citizenship rights, as he felt that they were not ready to hold political office or engage in political affairs. In addition, he wanted them to continue to have their own communal autonomy, including the right for the Beis Din, the rabbinic court, to put into cherem, communal ban, those who would not conform to rabbinic guidelines, and for them to adjudicate their own civil cases in their own bote dinim, in rabbinic courts. Although Dom's work did not produce immediate results, it did bring the issue of Jewish rights to the center of a public discussion, some supporting Dom's thesis and others fiercely opposing it. In order to further the cause of Jewish emancipation, Mendelssohn induced a friend of his, the Jewish physician Marcus Hertz, to translate into German the Vindicae Judaeorum, the Vindication of the Jews, written by Rabbi Menachem ben Yisroel, who we discussed in the previous lecture, a work which influenced Charles Cromwell to allow the Jews to resettle in England. Mendelssohn himself wrote an introduction to Hertz's translation, which he articulated his own views, which were at odds, at least in some cases, with Dom's. Mendelssohn argued that the Jews were entitled to full citizenship, irrespective of their private religious views. He also argued against the use of the cherem, rabbinic ban of excommunication. As he felt, and here we clearly see the influence of the Enlightenment, and where he parted ways from traditional Judaism, that religion was a personal choice, not something to be dictated or forced into. We quote here, on paragraph B on page 6, from Mendelssohn's introduction, to Hertz's translation. It is strange to observe what different garb prejudice puts on throughout the ages in order to oppress us and to raise objections to our admission as citizens to any given country. At a time when superstition was rampant, we were accused of wantonly desecrating holy places, of piercing crucifixes and making them bleed, of feasting our eyes on children we had first circumstances by stealth and torn apart, of using the blood of Christians for our Passover celebrations, of poisoning public wells, etc. We were declared guilty of heresy and obduracy, and were said to practice occult arts and black magic. For all that, we were tortured, robbed of our fortunes, driven into exile, even put to death. Now that times have changed, these calumnies no longer have the desired effect. Now we are being reproached for our superstition and backwardness, our lack of moral sensitivity, discriminating taste and refinement. We are judged incapable of pursuing the arts and sciences or plying a useful trade. Above all, we are rejected as unsuited to serve in the army or hold government office, owing to our imputedly uncontrollable penchant for cheating, usury, and lawlessness. These more recent charges have now taken the place of those earlier and cruder accusations as justification for our exclusion from the ranks of useful citizens or expulsions from the womb of the state. Formerly, every conceivable effort was made and all sorts of measures were taken to make us not into useful citizens, but into Christians. But the fact that we were too stiff-necked and obdurate, like obstinate, to let ourselves be converted was reason enough to regard us as superfluous ballast on this earth and attribute to us, depraved monsters that we are, any abomination that might expose us to the hatred and contempt of all mankind. Now that this zeal to convert us has abated, we are being treated with other superciliousness. People continue to keep us away from every contact with the arts and sciences or from engaging useful trades and occupations. They bar all roads leading to increased usefulness and then use our lack of culture to justify our continued oppression. They tie our hands and then reproach us for not using them. As you see, he was a beautiful writer. In the year 1778, the Prussian authorities transferred the jurisdiction of contested property rights from the Beisden, to the rabbinical court, to German civil authorities. The authorities, however, were willing to adjudicate these cases in accordance to traditional Jewish law, halacha, and at the request of Berlin's chief rabbi, Zvi Hirsch Levin, with whom Mendelssohn had a warm relationship, Mendelssohn compiled a German summary of the halachos, the laws of matrimony. Mendelssohn also had a hand in crafting an oath which was administered to Jews by the German civil courts. Here we see Mendelssohn's attitude to the use of Yiddish or Judendeutsch. He wanted them to use either proper Hebrew or proper German. And here we go on top of page 7. I should, however, not at all like to see a legal authorization of the Jewish-German dialect, Judendeutsch, nor a mixture of Hebrew and German as suggested by Mr. Frankel. This is Rav Yosef Yonah Frankel of Breslau. I'm afraid this jargon has contributed more than a little to the uncivilized bearing of the common man. And you see his prejudice against Yiddish. In contrast, it seems to me that the recent usage of pure German among my brethren promises to have a most beneficial effect on them. It would vex me greatly, therefore, if even the law of the land were to promote, so to speak, the abuse of either language. It would be much better if Mr. Frankel tried to put the entire admonition into pure Hebrew so that it could be read in either pure Hebrew, German or pure pure Hebrew, or possibly in both. Whichever might be best under the circumstances. Anything at all rather than a mishmash of languages. It was for this purpose, by the way, that he translated the entire Chumash, the five books of Moses, into German, pure Hochdeutsch. High German is a means of introducing German youth into the proper use of German language. He felt that if the barrier of language between Jew and non-Jew would be broken, the Jews would be treated with greater respect and ultimately be welcomed into German society and accorded equal rights. Despite fierce rabbinic opposition, of which we'll speak in the next lecture, Mendelssohn was extremely successful. Within a few decades, Yiddish had died out in Germany, apart from isolated phrases and expressions. With it came the loss of a common language between Eastern European Jewry and German Jewry. The secularization of German Jewry and their eventual spiritual decline. Mendelssohn also considered himself an Orthodox Jew, firmly adhering to halacha, Jewish law, and was considered such by the general community. His views and feelings, however, which he shared with his closest friends, were shaped by the general outlook of the Enlightenment and were highly unorthodox. This, I believe, explains one of the great mysteries surrounding Mendelssohn. From his six children, four eventually converted to Christianity. His daughter Brendel, or Dorothy, after 15 years of marriage with a Jewish banker, Simon Veit, ran off with a Christian man of letters, Friedrich von Schlegel. She converted first to Protestantism and then to Catholicism. Mendelssohn's daughter Henrietta, a brilliant woman in the mold of her father, eventually converted to Catholicism. His son Nathan, together with his wife, as well as his son Abraham, together with his wife and children, converted to Lutheranism. One of Abraham's sons was the famous composer and musician Felix Mendelssohn Bartholdy. In addition, of Moses Mendelssohn's many grandchildren, only one, Alexander Mendelssohn, remained a Jew. For many students of history, it comes as a real surprise, especially in the light of the fact that his family members all took pride in the fact they were descended from the famed Moses Mendelssohn. And his grandchildren, who had already converted, were involved in preserving his writings and legacy. Let us read together from the writing of Moses Mendelssohn to get a better understanding of his actual worldview and the legacy that he left. This is on page 7. This is a letter he wrote to Michaelis of Göttingen, who was one of the leading lights of biblical criticism. I am sure that you will treat the Psalms as poetry and not pay attention to the prophetic and mystical element which Christian as well as Jewish interpreters have found in them, only because they search for these elements, having searched for these elements only because they were neither philosophers nor literary critics. You have a sense of how he viewed, you know, rabbinic scholarship. And really it's this, even though it was in a private letter, but evidently it was this view that was felt by his family and his closest friends. Also, again, regarding Psalms, which he translated. But as regards, and this was a letter to John Zimmerman, a court physician in Hanover, but as regards a great many of the Psalms, I must admit, I simply do not understand them. The ones I find easiest to understand include many which I must class as very mediocre pieces of poetry, incoherent verses, repetitions of the same idea ad nauseum, and abrupt transitions and modulations which no amount of inspiration could justify. And it continues on, the character of some difficult psalms is such that you can read into them whatever you like, presumably because we do not know the events that inspire their composition, because the author, the time and circumstances of their origin are not known, or because some of the passages in the text have been corrupted, etc. Again, we find, again, him as a role as a biblical critic. This is lower criticism. I could cite for you two psalms which commentators of both nations interpret as messianic prophecies. I, for my part, have subjected them to more thorough study and have arrived at the conclusion that one is a satire on avarice, and the other, which is Psalm 110, which is referring to Mashiach and Hashem, is a piece of flattery composed by a court poet in honor of King David when the king's armies laid siege to Rabbah. So much for that. In a letter of his, this is from the Gesammelte Schriften, notwithstanding his speculative doctrine, this is in separate place, Spinoza could have remained an Orthodox Jew if he had not removed himself from the law. In other words, Spinoza, who did not believe in the divinity of Scripture, did not believe in miracles, his conception of God was that not of the theistic God who ruled the world, but really a pantheistic God who is nature in itself. But had he kept to the law, he would have remained in the community. You know, he would... what does that tell about himself? Evidently, and we'll see later, the important thing for Mendelssohn was not what you believed, but what you did. In a letter that he had to his friend, Gotthold Ephraim Lessing, who's a non-Jew, who's a very close friend of his, he writes, "If you but knew that we have just had 8 holidays, during which, as you know, one does not feel inclined to do anything except to be depressed." He was no chosid, this Mendelssohn, let me tell you. In a letter to Hertz Homburg, who later became one of the leading lights of the Jewish Enlightenment, but at that time had recently been the tutor to his son Joseph. Joseph was one of the children that remained a Jew. "My son Joseph has all but given up his Hebrew studies. Immediately following your tutelage, he unfortunately fell into the hands of a scholar who proved to be a hollow Baal Pilpul, dialectician. And as much as Joseph loves intellectual acuity and scholarly disputation, he lacks a sense for real pilpul. As you know, it takes a very special kind of instruction to develop a taste for this sort of mental exercise. Though both you and I underwent this training, you'll recall that we agreed Joseph's mind should rather remain a little duller than be sharpened in so sterile a manner. Well, the distaste he felt for his teacher instructions made him reject all Hebrew studies. He is, however, making good progress in the natural sciences. Right now, it might therefore be best to let him study whatever he wants or feels inclined to. This would, to say the least, not be detrimental to him if he were indeed to become a businessman. Or he could, if need be, do what his father had to do, muddle through now as a scholar, now as a businessman, though this carries with it the danger that one ends up not being really either." But evidently, by the fact that his son stopped studying Torah, really didn't bother him that much. Can you imagine a Lithuanian rabbi writing that his son has stopped studying Torah? You know, it's okay. He'll study the natural sciences and go into business. Nishka Ferla. Can you imagine? He writes here, this is a letter to Johann Caspar Levater, who was the Swiss theologian, which he had debate with. "In matters of fundamental religious or ethical convictions, I am a dogmatist. That is to say, I've made up my decision to firmly stand on the ground where I believe I can find the greatest measure of truth. But when it comes to judging my neighbor, I am a skeptic. That's to say, I have my doubts, for I greatly distrust my ability to convince any man of the truth of my own convictions, the more so since I grant him the same right I claim for myself, the right of free religious choice." In other words, I feel comfortable with these ideas, and that's why I embrace them. If you feel comfortable with your ideas, that's fine too. In a certain sense, there really is no absolute truth that one could really... But it's really the truth that one feels comfortable with. Again, this is from his Gesammelte Schriften. "I recognize no eternal verities, but those that have been grasped by the human reason, demonstrated as well as validated by the human intellect. In Judaism, there's no conflict between religion and reason, no revolt of natural cognition against suppression by faith. Judaism has no revealed religion in the Christian interpretation of the term. This is really his chiddush. In other words, this is his novel way of viewing things. That Judaism is not a religion of belief, but rather of law. It has divine laws, commandments, precepts, maxims, instructions about the will of God, but it has no dogmas, no doctrines, no universal truths. These the Eternal revealed to the Israelites in the same manner as this to all other men, by nature and fact, never by word or letter. I mean, this really runs counter to all of Jewish tradition, but it really felt as a person influenced by the Enlightenment. Basically, he felt all eternal truths could be understood by the mind itself. Therefore, God didn't even bother telling them this. He told us what to do. And again, in terms of his view of the Jewish religion as a whole, he says, I cannot deny, however, that I discovered certain holy human additions and abuses which, alas, badly tarnished the original luster of my religion. All of us who, in our search for truth, wish we could wipe out such poisonous secretions without doing damage to all that is authentic and good in our religion. Which basically find the seeds of reform. And again, in his Gesammelte Schriften, he writes, for this reason, all our endeavors should have only one goal, do away with the misuses that have crept into these ceremonies, to fuse them with a genuine, authentic meaning. This way, the original script, blurred beyond recognition by hypocrisy and clerical ruse, might become legible and intelligible once again. And this is finally in this section. We have a letter here that he wrote to Rabbi Yaakov Emden, which was a preeminent Talmudic scholar during the time, which we've discussed him in previous lectures. According to the Rambam, in order to have a portion of the world to come, one must believe in the Torah. One believes in the revelation of Sinai. Whether a person is a Jew or a non-Jew, this historic fact, according to the Rambam, is a necessary ingredient to have a portion of the world to come. With this, Mendelssohn took issue, and he writes to Yaakov Emden, are we to assume that all the inhabitants of the earth from sunrise to sunset are condemned to perdition if they do not believe in the Torah, which is granted solely as the inheritance of the congregation of Jacob? What then are those peoples to do that are not reached by the radiant rays of the Torah? Does God act like a tyrant when he deals with his creatures, destroying them, extirpating their name, even though they have done no wrong? But he's, from this, just to give you like a sense, his belief system was very different, even though outwardly it seemed from those of his parents, of his teachers, and really of thousands of years of Jewish tradition. We can see in a certain sense who Mendelssohn was, we saw from his children. We see from the circle of those who were close to him. We've quoted in previous lectures from Solomon Maimon and from his autobiography. It's just interesting how he describes how he first met Mendelssohn. He says, this is how he was a Talmudic student, he was a scholar, he threw everything away, and he came to Berlin. And he started, this was the beginning of his readings, of his developing his own philosophy. And Maimon writes, I also compare these new metaphysical doctrines of the German Enlightenment philosopher Christian Wolff with those of Maimonides, or rather of Aristotle, which were already known to me. I could not reconcile them. I therefore resolved to set these doubts forth in Hebrew, send what I wrote to Herr Mendelssohn, of whom I had already heard so much. When he received my communication, he was not a little astonished of it. He replied at once, my doubts were in fact well-founded, but I should nevertheless not allow them to discourage me, but continue to study with the zeal which I had begun. Thus encouraged, I wrote a Hebrew dissertation in which I questioned the foundations of revealed as well as natural theology. All the 13 articles of faith laid down by Maimonides I attacked with philosophical arguments, with the exception of one, namely that on reward and punishments, to which I conceded philosophical relevance as a necessary consequence of free will. I sent this dissertation to Mendelssohn, who was quite amazed that a Polish Jew who had scarcely got as far as seeing Wolff's metaphysics was so soon able to penetrate into their depths to the point of questioning their conclusions by means of a correct ontology. He invited me to call and accepted his invitation. But I was shy, and the manners and customs of the Berliners were strange to me. It was with trepidation, with embarrassment, I ventured to enter a fashionable house. When I opened Mendelssohn's door and saw him and other gentlefolk, there as well as the beautiful rooms and elegant furniture, I shrank back, closed the door, and had a mind not to go in. But Mendelssohn had noticed me. He was a very gracious and humble person. He came out and spoke to me very kindly, led me into his room, placed himself beside me at the window, and paid me many compliments about my writing. He assured me that if I persisted, I should in a short time make great progress in metaphysics, and he promised to resolve my doubts. Not satisfied with this, the worthy man looked after my maintenance also, recommended me to the most eminent, enlightened, and wealthy Jews of Berlin, who made provisions for my board and other wants. I was given the freedom of their tables, and their libraries were open to my use. It didn't bother Mendelssohn that he really was not a believing nor practicing Jew. But he wanted to encourage people who had the love of philosophy. And he continues on, a number of young Jews, this is from Solomon Maimon, from all parts of Germany had united during Mendelssohn's lifetime to form a society under the designation Society for Research into the Hebrew Language. They correctly observed that the evil conditions of our people, morally as well as politically, had its source in their religious prejudices, in their want of rational exposition of the Holy Scriptures, and the arbitrary expositions to which the rabbis are led by their ignorance of the Hebrew language. Accordingly, the object of their society was to remove these deficiencies, to study the Hebrew language at its sources, and by that means to introduce a rational exegesis. For this purpose, they resolved to publish a monthly periodical in Hebrew under the title Hama'asef, in the collector, which was to prevent expositions of difficult passages in scripture, Hebrew poems, prose essays, translations from useful works, and the like. And this periodical, by the way, appeared from 1783 to 1797, first in Königsberg, then in Berlin, last in Breslau. And Mendelssohn encouraged this and was one of the early contributors as well. To give you a sense of how Mendelssohn and his group were successful in changing the face of Berlin Jewry, let me quote to you from a letter written by David Friedlander, a leading member of Mendelssohn's circle and the organizer and supervisor of the Freie Schule, the free school, a Jewish school where the ideals of his Enlightenment philosophy was taught. This letter was written in March 30th, 1788. Quote, this is a few years after Mendelssohn's death. The Talmud is no longer studied. We have no yeshivas. Our rabbis are, thank God, powerless. And in 10 years, no one in Berlin will know anything at all about the Talmud. Although Mendelssohn is best known in the non-Jewish world for his works on general philosophy, towards the last part of his life, his major creative philosophical efforts were focused upon defending Judaism from its Christian critics in the light of the rationalism of the Enlightenment. It was precipitated by the translation of a work by the Genevan scholar Charles Bonnet, by a certain liberal preacher from Zurich, which we quoted previously, Johann Caspar Levater, who was actually an admirer of Mendelssohn's, entitled in the German translation, in Untersuchung der Beweise des Christentums, Investigation of the Proofs of Christianity, Levater published it in the year 1769 with an open letter to Mendelssohn to, quote, either refute the book publicly or if he found it to be logical, do what wisdom, love of truth, and honor required, what Socrates would have done if he had read the work and found it irrefutable. Mendelssohn replied to Lavater in public as well. He pointed out that he had previously avoided public discussions on questions of faith. It was partly based on, as we quoted before, in matters of fundamental religious or ethical convictions, I'm a dogmatist, as we quoted before. That is to say, I make my decisions firmly stand on the ground where I believe I can find the greatest measure of truth. When it comes to judging my neighbor, I'm a skeptic. That is to say, I have my doubts, for I greatly distrust my ability to convince any man of the truth of my own convictions, the more so since I grant him the same right I claim for myself, the right of religious choice. Therefore, he felt, I can't debate Judaism. What you want to believe is what you want to believe. In addition, because of the suppressed legal and social status of the Jews, though the public debate would only engender ill will, would have serious consequences for the Jews. In his words, I am a member of an oppressed people. Mendelssohn himself, before replying, had applied and received permission from the Berlin Consistory to answer Lavater. Mendelssohn made the point in his open letter that Judaism, in his opinion, does not encourage missionary activity. The righteous of all nations have a portion of the world to come. This began a further exchange of letters also involving Bennett himself, as well as the Crown Prince of Brunswick and others. To the thinkers of the Enlightenment, Christianity was the religion of reason. Judaism, on the other hand, was a relic of the past, the religion of a pre-rational mindset. In addition, in the year 1782, a pamphlet was published criticizing Mendelssohn for his inconsistency in remaining a loyal Jew, yet embracing the Enlightenment's tolerant views which undermined such allegiance. And this is from the pamphlet, "Clearly ecclesiastic law, armed with coercive power, has always been one of the cornerstones of the Jewish religion of your fathers, and the Evacherim. How then can you, my dear Herr Mendelssohn, continue to abide by the faith of your fathers and, by removing the cornerstone, shake the whole edifice, contesting the system of law that was given by Moses, claiming the authority of divine revelation? If it is possible," he quote, continues on, "to abolish ecclesiastical privilege," means the cherem, "which is based upon positive Mosaic laws, why should it be impossible to cancel for the nation's benefit mere rabbinical measures of late vintage, which create such detrimental barriers between Jews and Christians? Yet you, my most worthy Herr Mendelssohn, have abandoned the faith of your fathers. One more step, and you have become one of us." The result of all of this was soul-searching on the part of Mendelssohn, and his classic work in defense of his views on Judaism and Enlightenment philosophy entitled Jerusalem. Because of the time restraints, again, said I'll leave it to you really to go through the various quotes. On one hand, he believed that, as we stated before, that God gave us the freedom to know the truth. And the truth is not something which is dictated by the Torah or taught by the Torah or by the oral tradition. It's something we can, on our own, arrive at. What the Torah gave us was a way of living a life. And that's really his thesis, which again really flies in the face of everything really that you know about the Torah. And about the Talmud. The Talmud is not just the law, it's a book of law, it's a book of philosophy, it's a book of metaphysics. And all of this Mendelssohn would deny. But again, this is, I think that it's important on your own to read these quotes. I would like to conclude, though, with a quote from Rav Shamsher Fol Hirsch. In his 19 letters, this is letter 18, which is published in 1836. Which would really describe how subsequently the Orthodox world looked at Mendelssohn. "When the external yoke began to grow lighter and the spirit felt freer, there arose again a brilliant personality who inspired great respect. This was Moses Mendelssohn, who, by his commanding influence, has led the later development up to this very day. This commanding individual had not drawn his mental development from the wellsprings of Judaism, was great chiefly in philosophical disciplines, in metaphysics and aesthetics. He studied the Bible only from the philological and aesthetic point of view. He did not build up Judaism as a science from within itself, merely defended it against political stupidity and pietistic Christian insinuations. Personally an observant Jew, Mendelssohn showed the world and his brethren it was possible to be a strictly religious Jew, yet to shine forth as a German Plato. The words "and yet" were decisive. His followers contented themselves with developing the study of the Bible in the philological, aesthetic sense, with studying the Mora, this is the Mora Nevuchim, the guide to the perplexed, and yet pursuing and spreading the humanities. But Judaism, Bible, and Talmud were neglected. Even the most zealous study of the Bible was of no avail for the proper understanding of Judaism, because it was not treated as the authoritative source of doctrine and instruction, but only as a beautiful poetic storehouse from which to draw rich supplies for the imagination. With the Talmud thus neglected, and practical Judaism thus completely uncomprehended, it was but natural that the former symbolizing and abstract interpretation of Judaism, which had for a time been in the background, again became prevalent. It was carried to an extreme which was threatened to destroy all of Judaism. And he continues on, people should have asked themselves, is Moses the son of Maimon, or Moses the son of Mendelssohn, really identical with Moses the son of Amram? This is Moshe Rabbeinu. There must be sense in all of the commandments, in particular as regards those which declare themselves as being instructive, which call themselves ages, testimony, this is a memorial or symbol. It must be possible to find the spirit inherent in them. This attempt was never made. Moreover, many did not wish to make the attempt or to attain the results. For a spirit had come from the West which mocked everything holy and knew no greater pleasure to make them sound ridiculous. Together with it, there entered a longing for sensual enjoyment, which eagerly embraced the opportunity to rid itself so easily of burdensome restrictions. Those motives combined to induce people to tear down the barriers erected by the law, the Torah, till human conduct became one dead, dull level. In the next lecture, we'll cover the efforts of Mendelssohn and his circle to further hasten the assimilation of German Jewry into the surrounding culture, perhaps Mendelssohn's most long-lived legacy. In the attempts by the leading rabbonim, rabbinic authorities, to slow or halt the process, as well as the contribution of the great rabbinic thinkers of the time to create an exciting alternative to the secularization of Jewish life. And we'll be focusing primarily on the life of Rabbi Yechezkel Landau, the author of the Noda B'Yehuda, who really was a commanding figure of the time and an opponent to basically all that Mendelssohn stood for. Now, are there any questions?
Two things. One, as far as his children said that they were, that they had converted, did this bother Mendelssohn whatsoever, and did they do so during his lifetime or after?
Yeah, the question is, that the conversion of his children, did it bother Mendelssohn? The conversion occurred many years after he died. His children were very, relatively very young when he passed away. But nonetheless, the fact is that 4 out of 6 actually converted, and of his grandchildren, only one remained a Jew is rather telling. Yeah. The question basically is was the conversion of religious conviction, or was it because of social convenience? I believe on the bottom level, Mendelssohn and his group, in other words, Mendelssohn's at least his followers, Mendelssohn himself had been so steeped in the Talmud, there was at least part of him on an emotional and non-rational level, he felt a great connection to the Jewish community. On the rational level, he didn't, but there was, at least there was a struggle within Mendelssohn himself. Those who had not been immersed, you know, in that world of Talmud, had no such feelings. And on the contrary, felt very little closeness to the historic Jewish community at all. It was an embarrassment. The Jews were considered unrefined, uncouth, uneducated. And as we find Jews up until this day, they really felt very embarrassed by their Jewishness. But they really wanted very much to become part of the universal culture, and that's what they did.
Did he reject the revelation?
You're asking, Mendelssohn himself believed in revelation. He was a Maimon. He had in him a very strong connection to the... He believed in the revelation. He believed that the Torah was a divine document. He did not evidently believe in the oral tradition. And that's why he felt that where it came in conflict with Enlightenment thinking, he would keep the revelation itself, but not necessarily anything that conflicted with his own beliefs. They denied the authenticity of the oral tradition. It was just one step to deny the Torah itself. Yeah. You're asking about how the beyond Berlin, how did these ideas how were they accepted? Berlin, of course, was the focal point, but from Berlin, actually, it spread out through all of Europe and Eastern Europe as well. It took time, but these ideas really caught on like wildfire. That really became the dominant ideas in Germany. And it's really these ideas, an altered form, became the basis of reform. Eventually, the Orthodox Jews were a small minority of German Jews. But without the Talmud, and without this, as we started the lecture, without this idea of being immersed in Torah, it has no kiyum, it can't survive. Okay? We'll see you in 2 weeks in that session. Tavach. Thank you.